Welcome to the History Nerds United podcast. I'm your head nerd, Brendan. Thank you so much for being here. Big episode today. Hampton Sides, one of my favorite writers, his new book, The Wide White Sea, on the final voyage of Captain James Cook, one of my favorite historical figures. This is a big deal for me. Lived up to the hype. This book is so good, by the way. I'm telling you right now, it's April. I'm guaranteeing it will be one of my top five books for the year. It is that good. I'm going to shut up. Let's talk to him. And here we are with author Hampton Sides, The Wide, Wide Sea, Imperial Ambition, First Contact, and The Fateful Final Voyage of Captain James Cook. Hampton, thank you so much for coming on.
It is really great to be with you. Appreciate the invite.
Hampton, I hate to start off sounding like I'm trying to kiss your butt, but there are TV shows that are appointment viewings, right? As soon as they come out on streaming, people like have to have them. You are one of those authors. Like, do you know that? Is there pressure on you when you're putting out a new book, or you're like, just this is what it's going to be and I'm going to put it out there?
Well, I certainly like to hear that. I do take a long time, sometimes too long, it seems like, to write these books. And I'm glad that there are fans out there. I would call it a very diehard small group of people, but who just, they're history nerds is what they are. And a lot of times they're a little older than you are. Most of the people who seem to read and buy history are well into their 70s and 80s. And I have a theory about why that is. There's something about your lifespan and you begin to see your life in different terms when you get to be older. Great to know that there are some younger guys like you who also wait for my books to come out. I'm relieved that this particular book, Wide White Sea, is out. It took forever, it seemed like, because of all the travel involved. COVID got in the way of a lot of these trips that I was doing. So it is finally out and I'm elated and relieved and excited.
And what made you decide to take on Captain James Cook, especially specifically his final voyage? I have to think when you're talking about trips, the fact that you have to go to Hawaii must have been a pretty good selling point.
Well, this is a semi-facetious answer in the sense that our kids are grown up and my wife is able to travel with me more. And she, some of my previous books are set in Korea, North Korea, Siberia, obscure places in the Philippines. And this time my wife was sort of saying, why don't you pick a book that involves travel to places that, we could go together and have a good time. And I said, well, how about Captain Cook? And she's like, where did he go? I said, well, where didn't he go? He went to French Polynesia and New Zealand and Australia and Hawaii and Alaska and all these great places. So much of the travel was sometimes hard to get to these places. Some of them fairly remote, but I would not describe it as hardship travel or hardship research. A lot of it was a lot of fun. So I'm sure that was a factor. But, I've been interested in Captain Cook for a long time. He's one of those figures who looms large in history of exploration. He may be arguably the greatest of all time among scientist explorers. I mean, it's not just that he had one voyage. He had three voyages, each one equally ambitious and important. He was also an amazing map maker, someone who knew how to run a ship and keep things on course. He never had a single death from scurvy on any of his voyages. On and on it goes in terms of his accomplishments. But I became more and more interested in Cook when he became more and more controversial. In recent years, all over the Pacific, particularly Polynesia, he's become, the symbol of colonialism. And his statues have been pulled down and vandalized and splattered with red paint. And I always seem to gravitate toward controversial characters because it means that although they're historical characters, they still have a pulse, in current society. People seem to care. Something about Cook animates and agitates people in all kinds of ways. And that is a good starting point, I think, for a book, if you want a book to have any kind of resonance today. So that's the first part. In terms of which voyage, I originally thought, maybe I can write about all of his voyages. Just in narrative terms, that's a massive undertaking. Each one of these voyages was, 2, 3, 4 years in length. Hundreds of people involved in these voyages. Dozens and dozens of islands and different foreign lands that he visited. It's too much of a story to really get into, at least for the kind of writing I like to do, which is a little more compact kind of narrative. So I, it's like, all right, pick one of the voyages. And I decided very quickly that as an American writer writing about a British captain, I needed to look at the third voyage because it involves a lot of action that took place in what is now the United States. His mission is really to leave England. Interestingly, in July of 1776, just as the American Revolution is getting started, and go around the world, go up the Pacific, and begin to map the Northwest coast of North America in search of that fabled waterway, which doesn't exist. Well, it kind of does now because of global warming, but that waterway that we, you know, they refer to as the Northwest Passage. And to try to figure out if there's a waterway through or over Alaska that reach the Atlantic Ocean. Forgot to mention along the way to present-day coast of Oregon, he stumbles upon this amazing archipelago that we call Hawaii, and he was intrigued by it. You can't say it's a discovery because, of course, the Polynesians discovered it, but he was certainly the first European discoverer to make landfall and meet the locals and describe them. And so a lot of the action takes place, of course, in Hawaii. So it's really British voyage, but it's very much an American tale. And that's why I focused on the third.
And in the introduction, you start to talk about how you're going to take into account not necessarily how we look at things today, but how we can look back on these things today, imperialism, things like that, which I thought was interesting because especially nowadays that can really turn readers off. But it's amazing that in applying some of the way we look at humanity and how you should do things today, Cook was, and not to say that he was perfect, but he was really way ahead of his time. As you mentioned, like even as a ship captain, he was, especially up until the final voyage, very humane with both his men and the people he kind of ran into. Can you put that kind of into context? When we say he was a lot better than most ship captains, what does that mean?
Well, he lived in an age where the navies of Europe were unbelievably cruel. I mean, the captains of these ships were unbelievably cruel. They were master and commander. They were absolute, you know, sovereigns of their ship. And you apply the lash discipline. I mean, it was draconian. You know, the punishments could be draconian. Cook was different in that way. His first two voyages, especially, he was, I don't want to say he was kind. He was very stern and very, very rigid in his enforcement of discipline, but sparing with the lash, very concerned about their health and all the maladies that come with long distance voyaging from scurvy to dysentery. And, you know, he was very kind of almost scientific about cleanliness. Some of these ships, they were very often extremely filthy and, of course, rat infested and cockroach infested. And he's constantly coming up with sort of semi-scientific approaches to how to clean the ship and keep it disease free. He was also very, I would say, unusually interested in and sympathetic toward the people that he encountered along the way, the Polynesians primarily, and Australian Aborigines. This was in a day when most ship captains would just make landfall somewhere, try to exploit the local resources, water, wood, animals to eat, and they would often do that at gunpoint, and then they would move on. And it was all about, you know, European superiority, and maybe they also might try to convert the locals to Catholicism or something and try to make them look like, act like Europeans. Cook was not that way. He came from an Enlightenment era philosophy that, you know, their job was to document these people. What do they wear? How do they carry themselves? What are their rituals like? It was like he was a proto-anthropologist. He certainly had no formal training in that regard. It was not even a discipline yet, anthropology per se. But on his first voyage, he had had a number of these gentlemen scientists on board, including Joseph Banks, the famous botanist. And he had learned from Joseph Banks, you know, just like slow down and document what you see and try to do it with a certain discipline and with a certain genuine curiosity. So when he came back to England, and these volumes were published, I mean, they're full of just amazing descriptions of all these far-flung places and all these far-flung people and species that had never been encountered by Europeans. These are gorgeous, you know, multi-volume, folio-sized books that were published with engravings and beautiful art. So this was different. This wasn't just your, you know, glory hound explorer who's just going out there to claim land and, you know, plant the flag for the empire, although he did a certain amount of that, to be fair. It was more sort of the age of enlightenment and go out there and learn stuff. You know, what does the world look like? What is the shape of the planet? These were real questions that concerned all three of his voyages.
I really found it interesting from the perspective of he was in charge, right? We talk about that, like he was a ship captain, he was in charge, but he really did seem to care about the people he ran into. I mean, especially on the third voyage, you point out there's multiple times where he's not letting his sailors get off the ship because he knows they're just going to spread STDs to everybody. And it wasn't necessarily like my crew's going to run off. It's that he really thought ahead about what this would do to the population that they were at, that they weren't better than them. Like, they had to look out for them just as much as he would his own crew.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you'll hear now that people say that Cook's voyages spread syphilis and gonorrhea, and that's one of the reasons he's hated today, is introducing disease to these places. But if you read his journals, and particularly his third voyage journals, at every island he brings this up. His men are going to have some fun on the beach. That's another whole aspect of the story that still boggles my mind, is how enthusiastic participants these Polynesian women were. I mean, it wasn't just like the men had to go force themselves upon these women. They're, for whatever combination of reasons, there was a deep curiosity on the part of the Polynesian women. And I mean, it's like freaking orgies on the beach, orgies on the boat decks, down in the holds, up in the rainforest. It's just, there's more sexual encounters going on than you can keep track of. And believe me, I trimmed it way back. It's just dominates the journals of so many of these men. And you have to remember, most of these guys were 16, 17, 18, 19 horny sailors who couldn't believe their good luck and their good fortune when they came to places like Tahiti and were these beautiful women who seemed to be interested in them. I don't know why. They think about what these men must have looked like and smelled like. Circling back to your point, Cook was very aware that these men were spreading gonorrhea and syphilis, and that in turn, the Polynesians were spreading it back to his own men. You know, it was everything goes around, comes around. And he wrote about it incessantly in his journals. And he would have his surgeon literally strip down every man and look at their genitals. And if anyone had any sign of one of these diseases, he would not let them come ashore. Nonetheless, it happened. The other thing is the women are coming aboard the ships and sometimes dressed as men so they can get in the holds of the ship. It was a constant factor in the story. You know, all these books that I've written prior to this, I've written a lot of He-Man, macho tales of exploration and war, men in very tough situations. And my friends say, you know, kind of half facetiously, you know, dude, you know, you need to maybe think about having some sex in some of your books. And because I never have. And now I've got the opposite problem, more than I know how to process and figure out. But it is a constant theme in the third voyage.
Now, as an author, is Cook one of those characters that makes you kind of pause for a second? Because he is well known as a sphinx when it comes to his emotions. No one has any idea, really, about his interior life. He had a wife who he barely saw. All of these different things kind of come to him. He does all these amazing things. There's all these journals and everything. But knowing him is basically impossible at this point. As an author, does that give you pause, or is it almost a challenge to you to make him human?
Yeah, Sphinx is probably a really good way to put it. He was a very laconic man in a profession that seemed to have a lot of laconic men, not very emotional. He wrote a lot. He wrote down a lot of things that maybe is a million words, but most of what he's writing about is things like the viscosity of the mud at the bottom of the harbor where he anchored, or, you know, the barometric pressure, you know, at a certain place, or the wind direction. He's not telling you what he really thinks and feels. And he's also going to these outrageously beautiful places, pristine places. He has no gift for poetry or rhapsody, you know, when he's describing some beautiful place. He's from Yorkshire originally, a place famously known for people who are get straight to the point, no nonsense, maybe a little bit dour. He was raised as an apprentice in the shipping industry in the merchant marine by a bunch of Quakers who are also kind of famous for being laconic and dour and tough, but also fair and frugal and eschewing all sorts of ostentatious behavior. He's a very modest guy. This is one of the many things I love about Cook, is that he really did not put himself at the center of the story at any point, even though he was master and commander. He was the center of the story. This is just one little fun fact. He never once named a single feature in all the thousands and thousands of things he named on all of his voyages. He never named a single feature after himself or after any members of his family. In a profession that was your bragging rights, you know, if you discovered a new place and it didn't seem to have a name, you could just name it. He named all kinds of things, but he didn't name anything after himself. You will see his name all over the place, but that's because the Admiralty put his name on that map, or his name came up later, but it was affixed by someone else. But yeah, the flip side of all that modesty is what you're talking about. Like, he's emotionally so distant, you can only guess what he's really thinking and feeling. It is a challenge. And you have to just focus on his actions and sort of infer what he might be thinking and feeling by the things that he did. I think throughout the book, it was kind of like, after all these years, I think I spent 5 years on this project. I still don't know if I could say that I really understand him or really know him. I have flashes of insight, but it's really difficult. Now, what compounds that problem is that his wife that you mentioned, late in life, for reasons that are completely inexplicable, she decided to not even just throw it away, burn all of her personal papers and all of his letters to her, anything that might have given us an insight into their family life. You know, they had a bunch of kids, and even though he was away much of their marriage, they were close and he was true to her. And he wasn't one of those guys going ashore and having sex with the locals. He apparently abstained from all of that business and was true to his wife, Elizabeth. And she lived to be 90, which is amazing back then to live to be 90, as she burned all those papers. So there goes one of our great potential sources for understanding this guy.
Yeah, by the end of the book, my thought was, if I'm going to go on a 4-year voyage, I want Captain Cook in charge of it. But if I'm having a drink at the bar, he'd suck as a drinking companion.
He apparently had a little bit of a, you know, smirk and a smile. Sometimes he could crack a little bit of a joke. I don't know if, you know, Yorkshiremen have a very dry sense of humor. He was very eloquent, but straight to the point. He did drink sparingly, but you wouldn't want to have a drink with him. That probably wouldn't be a barrel full of laughs.
Now, we talked about a few of his good attributes. One of the reasons that I'm sure, especially for the third voyage, he seems to change a bit. There is just all of a sudden an edge to him. And the story, too, is he wasn't even supposed to do this voyage. In fact, his number two was supposed to take over and do this voyage. Were you able to discern exactly what pulled him back to the sea? Was there a little bit of ego in him that he felt like there was something out there still to do? Was he just a guy that could never be on land for too long? What put him back into the quote-unquote driver's seat?
Early in the book, I talk about how this mission had been launched and this other guy, Captain Clark, his loyal, like number two, was going to be the captain. It was going to be a very ambitious voyage, just as ambitious as Cook's first two voyages. And this was to go over there to Alaska and try to find this Northwest Passage, which was still the biggest obsession of the British Empire and of the Admiralty. You know, so many men had suffered and sometimes died in pursuit of this, the Northwest Passage. And usually they had gone from the Atlantic side, or always they had gone from the Atlantic side or Greenland or somewhere from the Atlantic side trying to get to the Pacific. This time they're going from the Pacific trying to get to the Atlantic. I think the sheer ambition of this voyage was one of the factors that made Cook say, wait a minute, this is a big deal. This would be the crowning achievement of my career if I could find this thing. It's such a weird thing to say because the Northwest Passage exists. It's up there. There are various ways up and over Canada, but it was always locked in ice and it just wasn't practical. No one could really find it. Only in recent years has it been semi-practical to do it. So I think he was a little jealous of his number two. Like, wait a minute. This was a big, big thing. It also came with a very large financial prize. 20,000 pounds was to the man who found this passage. People forget this, but he was quite poor. He came from very modest means, a bunch of kids, and he needed the money. And the third thing was, yes, he was miserable on shore. A few months, get in touch with his wife, get in touch with his kids a little bit, go around, meet some of the, you know, he was, I think, enjoying to some extent his celebrity after his second voyage. Everyone wanted a piece of him. You know, he was going to the salons and coffee houses and gentlemen's clubs. And he was invited to become part of this thing called the Royal Society, which is a very, very prestigious scientific club. And the greatest painters in England were painting his portrait. He'd become a hero, you know, but he was miserable. After a few months of this, he wanted to get back out there. And I think there was just something. It is a weird thing, these, you know, circumnavigating the world. You'd think after you've done with one of them, you just want to hang it up, you know, because they're so hard on the body, hard on the psyche, you know. But no, most of these guys, they just can't wait to get back out there and do it again. I don't know if they're gluttons for punishment or sadomasochists or what. He just wanted to get back out there and be in command of another ship. And so he did. I think the Admiralty had some doubts about this number two guy, Captain Clark. Clark was just a wonderful man and someone who was very much beloved, but I think they thought he didn't have quite the gravitas that was needed to run this voyage. Because it's two different ships, by the way. It's It's Cook's main ship, the Resolution, and then another ship, a consort ship called the Discovery. Between the two vessels, there are over 180 people aboard. And you know, that's like running a small city, you know, and I think they thought they needed Cook to run that operation. But you're right. Third time around, by this time, he's a different man. He got hot-tempered, and he is quick to use the lash on his own men. And he also is in pain a lot. He's got something is physically wrong with him. There's a lot of forensic nerds out there and people who've speculated about what it was, that he had a parasite that was perhaps preventing his absorption of vitamins or, you know, something in his diet, because he did eat horrible food for the first two voyages and the third. So that's kind of one of the little themes running through the book, is trying to figure out what is wrong with this guy. Why has he changed so much? Has he just become a believer in his own celebrity? And part of it also has to do with the fact that it just takes forever for him to finally get to the point where he's prosecuting the purpose of the voyage, you know, which is finally to get to Alaska. He goes around the world, all sorts of adventures take place before he's up there starting his actual goal, which is to map northwest coast of North America.
A funny little tidbit, we talk about how Cook has changed and a lot of these negative attributes kind of seep in. However, he's still a lot better than most sea captains if you read enough of this stuff. And a perfect example would be somebody else who's actually on this trip, who people will know, Mr. Bly.
Yes.
Who later on would also show that what happens if you're a really, really bad sea captain. I think a lot of people don't realize that Mutiny on the Bounty, all of that stuff. The guy from that was on Cook's voyage here.
Yeah. William Bly is the master. They call him the master of the Resolution. It's a very important job. He's the where the rubber meets the road, nautical technician of the ship, you know. And he's learning as he goes from Cook, you know, arguably the greatest master of them all. So, yeah, Bly learned a lot from Cook on this voyage, and really considered Cook to be his mentor. The difference was Bly was just, he had this insufferable personality. Everyone remarks just about all the journals talk about what a douchebag he was. I mean, he was always right. Okay. I mean, and people who are always right, you know, even if they are right, just don't want to spend a minute in their presence. You know, he just thought he was better than everyone. I mean, it was really mostly just to do with his personality, but he was very competent. He was really good at mapping and charting and assessing the safety of a potential anchorage spot. Cook was always sending him out off in the small boats to find something out, and he would always come back with good information. And he was extremely dutiful and loyal and competent, but no one wanted to be with him for a second. Yeah, we've all known people like that. And then when that guy goes on to become the captain of a ship, like the Bounty, it really wasn't that he was so cruel. And that's the cliche, is that he was extremely cruel to his own men. But apparently that really wasn't particularly the case.
Another thread in this book that I absolutely love, a lot of times the indigenous people are just, you know, a monolith of people that are just there to be seen on the beach and things like that. But there's another passenger on this trip who really adds some flavor to this. And unlike Bly, it seems like everybody really liked him for the most part on the trip. Can you tell me a little bit about Mai and how he comes into the story?
Absolutely. On Cook's second voyage, they picked up a young Polynesian man, probably at that point about 19 years old, named Mai. I think they met him first on Tahiti, but they ended up picking him up on another island called Huaheine. This guy, Mai, wanted to go to England. He wanted to go back and see who these people were, and they agreed to do it. They brought him back to London. He became the first Polynesian to ever set foot on English soil, and he became a smash hit in London. He was a good-looking guy. He had a great smile. He was eager to learn about this new culture, and he became popular with the ladies. You know, he went to the estates and learned how to play, you know, backgammon and dressed like an aristocrat. And I was fascinated with the story of Mai and realized I got to make this a big part of the story, because first of all, so many of these books are about, yeah, like white folks going to Polynesia and describing Polynesian culture. Well, here you kind of turn the tables, and here's a Polynesian going into the heart of whiteness meeting King George III, meeting writers and artists and scientists. He learns English and he becomes this, they call him the noble savage, you know. Yes, there was a lot of latent racism, sometimes overt racism going on, but they also really, the English rolled out the red carpet for him in a lot of ways. He lived with Joseph Banks, the guy I mentioned earlier, the botanist. He also spent a lot of time at Lord Sandwich's estate. Sandwich was the first Lord of the Admiralty. Also, incidentally, the inventor of the sandwich, supposedly. He, for 2 years, Mai lived in England and had, for the most part, a very good experience. He also got inoculated for smallpox because that was something that they worried about with good reason. So the first purpose of the third voyage, which is the subject of my book, Cook was supposed to, en route to Alaska, he was supposed to drop off Mai back home in Tahiti with all his belongings, all these gifts he'd been given, all these animals he had been given by King George. I was trying, racking my brain, trying to find a good indigenous character who Cook might have met on one of these islands. But Mai fit the bill. He was just perfect. His story is rather sad and tragic after that, what happens to him. I won't go into it too much, but it does become a cautionary tale about, the unintended consequences of cultural exchange. Because by the end of this whole adventure, Mai is a very confused guy. He doesn't know if he's English, Polynesian, or something in between. He's got a foot in both worlds, and he's kind of a man without a country. It's a really complicated and ultimately pretty sad tale. But yeah, that's Mai for you. He's something else. And also, he's still famous to this day because Sir Joshua Reynolds, one of the most famous portrait painters in the history of England, painted a beautiful portrait of him called Portrait of Omai. They called him Omai instead of Mai. And it just was recently sold to the Getty Museum in Los Angeles for $62 million. It's considered his greatest painting. I think right now it's in England at the Portrait Gallery, but it is about to move to the Getty.
Well, speaking of other sad endings, we're skipping over a lot, but I guess spoiler alert for the listeners. I mean, it was 350 years ago, but Cook doesn't make it out of this one alive. He goes to Hawaii. And let me just jump right in. This is something that even if you're not a history nerd, you've heard this. When Cook gets to Hawaii, do they think he's a god?
I devote a few chapters to that very question. I get into this academic dispute that happened between two American anthropologists not too long ago in the 1980s and 90s. Marshall Salins is a University of Chicago anthropologist, and another guy, Gnanath Obaskieri, a Sri Lankan but now American anthropologist from Princeton, just went after it, hammer and tong, against each other on this question of, did the Hawaiians think he was the god Lono, the god of fertility, the god of renewal? It's a very complicated thing, but when Cook arrived on the big island of Hawaii, he arrived during this ceremony called the Makahiki. It was a season to celebrate the god Lono. And he just arrived right as the right season in the right way. And the adoration that the local Hawaiian people gave him upon his arrival, it was strange. I mean, they bowed down to him. They made him the centerpiece of this ritual at the temple, the heiau. They called him Lono. Cook had been treated very well in a lot of these islands, but nothing like this. This was like a different order of magnitude. I came to the conclusion that at least some of the Hawaiians did. And, you can argue that, well, maybe they didn't think he was a god. Maybe they thought he was like the manifestation of a god, or that he was someone playing the role of Lono in a kind of passion play. Or maybe the local priests just thought it made sense to call him that. in other words, it's good for the cult of Lono to say, oh, here's Lono. He's shown up. Worship him. What also made it more awkward and difficult for Cook was that, he decided to go along with this. He kind of acquiesced in this adoration. And I don't know exactly why he did it. I think he felt awkward about it, but he also figured, well, if they think I'm a god, we'll get a lot more things out of these people, more water, more hogs, more breadfruit, because they had really come to replenish their ships so they could go back to Alaska one more time to look for this Northwest Passage. The fact that he acquiesced in their adoration led to the American missionaries who came to Hawaii later. I don't know that I definitively say in the book that the Hawaiians thought he was a god, but I lay out all the arguments pro and con. I'll leave it for the readers to ultimately decide.
And as you mentioned, it's a lot of amazing coincidences. He shows up at the right time. He goes around the island in the right direction.
Yeah.
They go, they replenish, and then even the Hawaiians who think he's a god are kind of like, hey, Lono, it's time to go.
Yeah.
They go to leave, something happens, and Cook decides to turn around and go back. What I always think about, too, is if he just looked and said, you know what, we kind of overstayed our welcome. We're pretty sure there's other islands over here. Nothing that happens afterward happens, right? It's just this particular island was kind of burned for them as far as using it for replenishment. But do you think the Cook of the first two voyages turns around and goes back? I hate to do the history what ifs, but it feels like it was a lazy choice for him to turn around and go back.
Well, he had to turn around and go back somewhere because they encountered a storm, a very violent storm, and the foremast snapped in half. I mean, there was no question that they had to repair the ship and they couldn't just glue it together or something. They had to find a massive tree, you know, basically from one of the islands. In retrospect, it would have been much smarter for him to go to Maui or Oahu or one of these other islands, but he was still crawling up the coast of the big island of Hawaii. So he wasn't very far from Kealakeakea Bay, which is where they had been before. And he decided, we'll just go back to the place we know. We know that it's got a great anchorage. We know that there's plenty of wood. They treated us very well. They'll continue to treat us well. Well, as soon as they arrive back in the bay, it's a different world. They're like, what are you doing here? You're supposed to have left. If you were Lano, if they were the ones who believed he was Lano, you know, the season had moved on. It was a season of war now, season of politics and intrigue. The feasts were over. The celebrations were over. What are you doing here? And furthermore, if you were a god, why didn't you just fix your own damn ship? And so as soon as they came ashore, he and his men were treated completely differently. And the Hawaiians started stealing things and laughing at them and making fun of them. These 180 men had been living like, you know, high on the hog for weeks there, eating the greatest food and having, again, you know, sexual relations with these women and just having the time of their lives. But now it's a hostile environment. Things go very quickly from bad to worse. I know people know Cook died there, but I don't exactly like to get into the nitty gritty of it because that's the last, you know, quarter of the book is really all the different things that build up, you know, all the miscues and cultural misunderstandings that sort of escalate. This isn't a spoiler alert, but I mean, they hacked him to pieces on the beach, on the lava rocks, and bludgeoned him to death in front of his own men in a way that is just so shocking even today to think about how it all went down. You go down to that place in Hawaii, I mean, you can still feel the shock waves. You know, it's a really weird juju down there. There's a monument that is constantly, you know, it's visited by many thousands of pilgrims every year, but it's also vandalized a lot by local, you know, native Hawaiians who really don't like Cook at all. Wish he'd never come at all. I mean, it's so interesting, though, you know, the other great explorer that's often mentioned in the same breath as Cook is Magellan. What happened to him? He came ashore. He lost his temper. He got involved in some local stuff and he was hacked to pieces on the beach in the Philippines. And Cook was very conscious of Magellan and wrote about him. And, you know, I think he was trying to avoid his fate. And weirdly, ironically, it befell him as well. You know, the same, almost just identical outcome.
Hampton, this is one of the reasons that I have a personal rule of never staying at somebody's house for more than 3 days straight. Things just start to go wrong. If I could magically send you back in time and I can let you for an hour talk to any one person from your book, who would it be? I'm assuming it wouldn't be Cook because you probably wouldn't be able to get much out of him. But who would you choose if you could have 1 hour to talk to anybody from your book?
There's a surgeon on board of the ship. Samwell is Welsh, and he's a doctor, but he's really a poet. And he's the best writer of any of the journalists on the different ships, of any of the officers. He's lewd, and he's super intelligent, and he's got a great sense of humor. And he is also kind of a proto-anthropologist. His descriptions of tattooing and surfing, he gives us the very first like detailed description of surfing, which he sees in Hawaii, and it just blows his mind. And the way the Polynesians swim, and I quote him the most, I think, in the book, even more than, possibly more than Cook himself. He's the dude. And apparently everyone just loved him. He probably drank a little too much. And he went on to an interesting career, including becoming a pretty famous Welsh poet. He's certainly high on the list anyway. And this is such an ensemble story. There's so many interesting people like Bligh. You mentioned Bligh. Another young officer is on board the ship that becomes extremely famous. Vancouver, George Vancouver, learned everything he knew from Cook. And there's an American explorer named John Ledyard who figures prominently in the story. I mean, he's American born, but he's on the ship as well. You know, I do think that it's not a biography of cook by any imagination. It's really an ensemble story with all these kind of characters running through it. And, you know, when you think about it, they're all like in their 20s and they're having this unbelievable experience. And they all, so many of them go on to fame and fortune of their own later in life.
Well, Hampton leads right to my last question. There are people that are not history nerds, you know, like us. And they look at history and they say, oh, this is going to be boring, right? History is a class I took in high school. I don't need to read this. If I sat one of those misguided people in front of you and they said, why should I read The Wide, Wide Sea? What would you say?
Well, you know, one thing about this story is that it's history, but it's also a travel log. You know, it's like any great journey has its own arc, and it has, you know, each chapter you're in a new location, you got a new vibe going. If you like going on journeys, road trips, or, you know, any kind of story where the journey itself begins to become a character almost, you'll love this book. That's number one. Number two, I would say this is escapist literature in a sense that this is so far back in time. The world is so different. People's understanding of the world was so different. It is like, you know, Game of Thrones or, you know, some fantasy novel you might read, because just the nature of life, you know, this was a time when there's still possible for cultures to encounter each other that had no clue. I mean, like, you know, meeting the Aboriginal Tasmanians, for example. It's just like Star Trek, you know, where they go to another planet and they meet another people. Go back in time, you know, just go through this escape hatch into this other world. I think it's enjoyable. I think most people have told me they really just enjoy the journey. And then last but not least, it's kind of a forensic murder story. You know, at the end, you know, it all funnels down to those events on the Big Island where Cook is killed. Not just Cook, but four of his Marines and a lot of Hawaiians. And he's sort of like, how did this most disciplined of all explorers end up dead on the lava rocks of Hawaii?
Well, Hampton, I'm definitely one of the people that enjoyed the hell out of it. Thank you so much for coming and talking about it.
Thank you, sir, man. This was fun. I enjoyed it. We got to unite. All history nerds unite.
Yes, sir. And that's it for this episode. Thank you so much, Hampton, for coming on. The Wide, Wide Sea, going to be one of the best books of the year, people. Go out and get it. Hit us up, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. Don't forget the YouTube channel. Until next time, nerds, stay cool.
History Nerds United.